Okay, so today I want to talk about theories and models for HDR. So needless to say, this is a vast subject. I could spend the entire course in this. To create this course, class, I took a book. The reference is on the very last slide, edited by Jack Carroll, that gives a very nice overview of theories and model in HCI for HCI. So I'll first start to talk a little bit about what is a theory and a model, because I've discovered over the years that in general most students don't really know. And I don't think you are taught these things, at least in France. So we'll see. And then I'm going to look at theories and models that are used in HCI that come from psychology, perception and action first, and cognition and behavior. Then we'll look at models that are what were developed really within the field of HCI. And then we'll look at the models that come from computer science around software architectures for interactive systems. I'm going to try hard to be done at noon because my colleagues from the Institute group are going to come, and we're going to let you know, this is mostly for the MDO students, the internships that we are offering in our research group. And so if I'm too late, they will be very upset at me. So, okay, so models and theories. What's a model? What's a theory? Has anybody been taught these things?
Yeah.
Yes, good. You should not smoke. Okay, it's okay. I'll give you a break. But so, anybody else? No, you don't take classes on epistemology and what is science about and all these things. Okay, so a model is something that we create to account for some real phenomenon that we observe in the real world. And when you talk about model, it means that you are essentially simplifying reality. So you choose to focus on some aspects of the phenomenon, and you choose to ignore others. So if you're looking, for example, at mechanics, and you think of the effect of forces like gravity, well, you're going to probably make a model where you ignore some of the things that are not important for what you're looking at. Maybe you ignore friction. So the laws of Newton ignore friction, because if you drop something in the air, friction is low, well, unless it's a feather or something, and so it would complicate matters if you took into account all of the forces that happen. And so your goal is to be useful to a particular type of study. When we talk about model, we often talk about abstraction. And the process of abstraction is one where you, again, abstract out some things that are not important to focus on the ones you think are important. Of course, these are choices you make, and they may be wrong. It may be that some things that are important you threw away. If you think of the difference between traditional mechanics, Newton, versus Einstein, well, the difference is only in that in the theory of relativity, you take into account the speed of things relative to the speed of light, whereas in Newtonian mechanics, you don't. And for most of us, most of the time, it really doesn't make a difference. Now, if you try to understand how the universe was created and things like this, you could not abstract out some of these things. And so the difficulty you encounter every time we model something is this trade-off between precision and generality. What am I throwing away? What am I keeping? If I keep too many things, my model becomes complicated. I'm not going to be able to do anything useful with it. If I abstract out too many things, it becomes irrelevant. So then the question you may ask is, what do I do with a model? Well, there are different types of models used in science and technology. And one way to classify them is this one, is to say, well, I want a model to describe what I observe. So I want the ability to represent some aspects of a phenomenon. I'm not trying to understand it. This is just about observation. And so modeling means deciding what I measure and what I ignore in my measurement, for example. If I'm doing a completely different kind of things where I'm doing, say, ethnography or anthropology, where I observe people, well, there are things I'm going to focus on and things I'm going to ignore. Maybe I ignore the social structure and I focus on daily activities. Maybe this is a mistake and I should, in fact, include the social structure in my observations. But my goal here in the descriptive model is to be able to account for something I observe. And if people agree on multiple accounts, it's based on these descriptions that then I can build theories and frameworks, which I'll talk about in the next slide. Of course, we're more used to models as being predictive. There's a saying that science is prediction. If I can predict what happens if I do this and that, then it means I have a solid model. So, going back to mechanics, it's very powerful because, yes, I can predict if I drop something exactly how much time it takes to reach the floor. Physics laws in general are very strongly in a predictive way. And in fact, lots of money are being spent in equipment in physics to verify predictions given by models and theories. Now, in our field of HCI, when we talk about descriptive models, we most often talk about description of how users interact with the system, or description of users' activities. So we observe that, for example, the way people use social networks today is like this or like that, or the way they use email is like this or like that, or the way they perform their job, if they are, I don't know, a copy editor at a magazine, we observe what they do. So there are models that try to take into account these observations and to build rich descriptions out of that. We have a much harder time with predictive models. In fact, as we'll see, predictive models we have are often limited to very low-level aspects of human-computer interaction. So Fitts' law is a predictive model. I can predict with pretty good accuracy how much time it will take you to point to a target of a certain size at a certain distance. We'll see later on another one called Higgs' law. We'll see, or I've talked already about variance or evolutions of Fitts' law. And beyond that, there's not much. We'll talk about GOMS. I think you had a session in the TA, sessions with GOMS. And we'll see a version of GOMS that can do very pretty accurate predictions for higher level tasks. The problem is, if you want good prediction, you usually need a more complex model. So again, we get back to this trade-off. If it takes more time to create the model and make the prediction than it would take you to actually test it for real, maybe the model is not that useful. Finally, the last aspect of models, and that's something that you don't necessarily find in things like physics, in natural sciences, but more in technological areas, the power of a model is to be generative. It's to give you the ability to imagine new solutions to a problem. So if you're doing materials science, you study the properties of materials, and depending on how you study them, to get ideas on how to create a new material that has certain properties. A lot of chemistry is about that, is how do I create a chemical compound that has a certain set of properties? Well, this is based on the generative power of a number of models that exist in chemistry about the how different types of properties, maybe electric properties, various the way a particular material interacts with other materials, and sometimes you want to combine in one material things that only exist in different ones, and how do you combine them together? In HCI, I think it is important to have generative models because we always are in a situation where we need to design new solutions to sometimes old problems and sometimes newer problems. So it's good to have a way to think about the solutions other than just sitting down and looking at the sky and waiting for inspiration. Now, this does not necessarily include all the creative activities you can have, such as brainstorming and looking at the sky, because sometimes you get inspiration. But what I try to show when I talked about instrumental interaction is how the principles I talked about were helping us to think of new solutions. So I think models are important, but I also think that there are too many papers in the literature that talk about a model just for the sake of building a model. And I think when you define a new model of anything, you have to ask yourself, is it necessary? Isn't there already something out there that you can use? Because the property of model is to also share them with a community, so you can sort of build them on each other's work. If I build a new model, do I really need it? And what it is useful for? If it's just useful to, say describe something and nothing else, chances are this description has already been done by someone else in another way. So I see a lot of publications that talk about the new model for this and for that, and then they stop here. And I think you have to do more work to show why your model is useful. Now, in the course of the slides this morning, I will talk about a couple of things called notations. And the notation, and so this is, since this is a word you may hear, I put it here. A notation is a sort of a... it's not quite a model yet. It's really something designed to describe something, so it's for a descriptive model. But people use the word notation wherein they are honest, and they don't want to pretend to build a model when they have it. And so we'll see one, it's called UAN, User Action Notation. We'll see another one called the Cognitive Dimensions. And a notation is something that may be informal, that may be incomplete, that may be inconsistent, but that helps you to put your ideas down and communicate with others. It's not uncommon that a notation is a first stage and becomes part of the model, and the model becomes part of a theory. So what is a theory then? Well, when I talked about a model, I didn't talk about explaining anything. A model is about observing, it's about making predictions. If I give you a Fitts law and you plug in numbers, you can make predictions. It doesn't tell you anything about how pointing works. It can be generative, as I said, but the fact that it helps you imagine new solutions doesn't mean necessarily that it tells you how these things work. So a theory is really an attempt to explain reality. So the goal of a theory is to be explanatory. Now often this theory is going to be based on a model. But the problem that you have with the theory is how do you prove your theory is valid? Now, if you have a descriptive model, well, people can agree or disagree that what you're describing is actually a good account of reality or not. If you have a predictive model, it's very easy. Well, it's very easy. It can be very expensive. If you think of the LHC or the accelerators that physicists have to build to test their predictions, but you compare your predictions to reality, and so you have an easy way to show whether your predictive power is good or not. With generative, you can test whether the things you create are actually matching the goals that you set or not. With a theory, because it's about explanation, it's a lot more complicated. And for a long time, theories were just debated on a rhetorical or philosophical level. If you look at the history of sciences and how people discover the existence of air, or the distinction between the role of living organisms and things like this, they had theories and there were heated debates, but the scientific method took a long time to become something established. People were just trying to convince each other by arguing back and forth. And so the problem is that not just that your model should give valid predictions, but that the model itself is valid, that the explanation you're giving is correct.
How do you prove this validity?
How do you prove?
This validity of the theory.
Well, that's where Mr. Popper comes in. So, Karl Popper wrote a book, and his take is that you can only argue that what you're doing is a scientific theory if you can disprove it, there's a missing R here, through experiments. So that's what he calls, and then what's called now, falsifiability. So falsifying something is the following thing. I give you a theory, and I or someone else designs an experiment, and the result of the experiment will be able to tell me if my theory is false. So if I have a theory based on the model of Fitts' law that, or model of mechanical physics, that if I drop an object, it takes that much time to reach the ground. Well, we can run an experiment, time things, and see if it works or not. The critical thing to understand here is that I can never prove a theory to be right, which is annoying.
And also, like, some of the theories in sociology or other sciences, they're very dangerous to run experiments with.
Yes, we'll get to that. But first, the point is, it's not because my predictions are validated by experiments that my model is, or my theory is correct. It reinforces the theory. The more we try to break it, and the more it doesn't break, the more chances it has to be true. Now, if one experiment proves me wrong, then I'm dead. So what happens, of course, is if, again, we take the example of Newtonian versus Einsteinian physics or mechanics, is that a falsified theory gives ground to build a better model, a more refined theory. Because sometimes, it's rare that you get proven completely wrong. It's the results are not exactly what you expected. So if I drop an object, well, it will take a little bit longer because I ignore the resistance of the air, for example. In examples of Newton versus Einstein, at slow speeds, things are so close that it's very hard to measure the difference. So this notion of experiment is, on the one hand, very powerful. On the other hand, it puts a very high bar on what you need to do to not even prove your theory, but to just show that it's not wrong. If you look at physics, experiments can become very expensive. But our Chadron Collider was built exclusively to show the existence of the boson, the Higgs boson particle. Which even itself doesn't prove that much. It's just, if you find it, it proves that the standard model of physics may be right. Now, of course, they will run all sorts of experiments, and by learning more about this particle and others, it will give more proofs that the model is likely to be right. It will give more, it will disprove more of the other theories, and it will probably lead to a more refined model and more things to test and more billions to spend in accelerators. But okay, this is just a question of money. Now, as you were hinting, there are some experiments that are dangerous to run. So when you are not doing physics, but you do social sciences or you do economics, you know, well, we were just talking about the campaign and the election. The two candidates have two different theories about how to fix the economy. Well, the problem is they can't test them, right? for various reasons. And so we'll never know. We'll never know if the one that didn't get elected could have done a better job. Because even if he gets elected 4 years from now, things will have changed. So there are cases where you just cannot run the experiments. This is also true in many natural sciences. All the theories about the universe are very hard to test because we don't have extra universes to to spare and to test. So the bar that was set by Popper is really high. There are also experiments that you, so if we talk about psychology, for example, well, especially psychology, when you want to run examples with human subjects. Well, if you run experiments with animals, some people consider it's okay to hurt animals for the good of science. Well, we may stand in different grounds on this. It may depend on the animal. When it comes to human, people get pretty sensitive. Right. So, you don't want experiments that will hurt humans. Sometimes I feel when we do some of the pointing experiments, you know, they last an hour. You spend an hour pointing back and forth. It can hurt your arm. But there are experiments that are more dangerous, in my opinion. Well, first we always tell the participants in the experiment they can stop, they can rest, they can walk out, etc. I don't know if you're familiar with the Stan Milgram experiment in the aftermath of the Second World War. So he had a theory. He had a theory that if Germany had fallen to Nazi power, it was because Germans were more susceptible to authority than other people around the world. And so he started to test his theory. And before going to Germany, he needed a baseline in this experiment. When you do an experiment, you need to compare something. So you, if you're testing a condition, you need to test a group of people without the condition and the other with the condition. So if I'm testing pointing devices, I'm going to have a group using a mouse, another one using a trackpad, the third one using a joystick. So in this case, the theory was that the German people were different. So I used the American people as a baseline, and he conducted a series of tests. The experiment was as follows. You recruit two participants, you bring them to a room, and you have them decide who's going to be on one side of the experiment and who's going to be on the other. The experiment is the following. One person is going to ask questions to the other. If the other person answers the right, all goes well. If the other person gives the wrong answer, he or she is given an electrical shock. And the person asking the question is the one giving the shock. And there is this apparatus with a big dial, and the button, and you give a shot. And you are, and the person asking the questions is in a room where there is a scientist, someone with a white lab coat. And if the person does not want to give the shock, the experiment, the lab scientist has the instructions to tell people, you have to do it. If you agreed to do this, this is important for science, and you really have to do this. And of course, the more wrong answers you get, the more shock you give, and it ends at about 600 volts. Now, I don't know if you've literally put your fingers in the plug. already 100, 200 volts is pretty bad. So what he discovered is that amazingly to him and to, I think, everybody, people were extremely susceptible to the authority of a scientific figure that, like this scientist in the white lab coat, that says, yeah, you must give this shock. A lot of the people went all the way to the 600 volts. I mean, they were hating it, and they were complaining, and they were saying, no, I can't do this, I can't do this. But they were doing it. And that, I mean, that completely shattered Milgram, who didn't even try to conduct the experiment in Germany. So we'll never know if there is a difference. And on French television, a couple of years ago, they actually replicated this experiment, which I find absolutely stunning, because this has been the reason why now we take so many precautions when we run experiments with human subjects to make sure they can get out of the experiment whenever they want, and there are ethics review boards, and you have to submit your experiment through this board to validate it, etc., etc. Now, the thing I haven't told you is the person who's being asked the question, what's happening to him or to her? Well, in fact, there's no other person. When they ask the two people to come in as the two participants in the study, one is a fake, is part of the experimental team. And what they do is, in fact, there is one participant being tested, is the one asking the questions, and all the feedback he's getting is pre-recorded, which means that all participants hear the exact same feedback. It starts by the being unhappy, and then the screaming, and etc. So nobody gets hurt, except that a lot of people were traumatized by the experiment, traumatized by the idea when they came out of the room that they had, sat there for our time it took, and had delivered the electric shocks to someone they had met just a few minutes ago. So yeah, experiments can be dangerous.
Do you get institutional board reviews for your experiments here in the lab?
Well, this is something. It's a very good question, and the answer is we don't, and I don't like the fact that we don't, because we are very careful. The things we do are pretty innocuous. We ask people to use a technology, pointing technique or some kind of technique. Sometimes we make them look funny because they have to wear various sensors so we can scan their position and things like this, but there's nothing that we consider harmful. We've done it ourselves hundreds of times before. We ask other people to do it, but I would personally feel more comfortable if someone else, had a way to look at what we're doing. So this is quite unusual. In many countries, you have very strict rules, in the US in particular. Now, it's also a problem because sometimes they take 2 months to give you an answer of whether you can run this experiment or not. So it's, people who have to go through these review boards hate it. But the fact that we have no oversight here, I'm not very comfortable with.
Yes. Experiment that you explained. Before the experiment, they explained very well to the participants that they can leave any time, right?
Yes.
But when they were there, they said something else, the professor. So I wonder, because usually before an experiment, we always say, yeah, you can leave, you can quit the experiment, but they didn't do it anyway. So maybe this has a big influence.
Well, the thing is that we know that there are effects due to being part of an experiment. There's a Hawthorne effect and other ones. I think this design was extremely clever because yes, you tell people you can leave, but then you have this person who's also representing science, who's giving you instructions. And the whole goal was to, you know, how do you weigh those two things? And part of it is, yes, I want to perform well in the experiment. And now I'm confused, I think it's the Hawthorne effect. But one of these effects in the experiment is, yes, people want, they feel that they are the ones being tested. We always tell the participants when they are testing technique A versus B versus C, and usually there is a technique that's obviously something they use every day, like using a mouse, versus the thing we have designed, and so they know which one is new and which one isn't, and they figure out that, you know, we'd like them to like the new one. We don't really, but they feel like they are tested, and that if they don't perform as well, it's their fault. So there are effects of being in an experiment. But I think in the context of Milgram's experiment, it was part of the design to see the to put people in an experimental setup and see the effect of the authority figure in science. And I guess the theory behind this is that if it happens in that realm, it could happen in the political realm where the authority figure comes from a political power. So, running experiments is very tricky. Those of you in the M1 will have a whole class on this. I hope starting next year we'll be able to open it also to the M2 students. We had the usual problem with the schedules and all these things. But the point that is important here is this notion of falsifiability. You can never prove a theory right. You can reduce the chances that it's wrong. Now here I have a line on empirical law because I've talked about Fitts' law. And even though it has the name Fitts' law, law is a very strong name. It's not a theory as such because there is no explanation. If you think of the law of physics, there are explanations. We know why we end up with E equals MC squared or the formula for the time it takes for something to hit the ground. These are explained by a theory. The formula in Fitts' law is not explained. There are theories, less, about why is pointing governed by this regularity. But there are different theories, and at this point, you know, we don't really know if one is winning over the others. There's one theory which is that you correct your movement as you go in stages. Other theories are more tight control, but we don't quite know. So you can observe a regularity that you embody in the formula, but it's called an empirical law. It's not called a theory because it's not explanatory. Okay, so now we're going to go through some of these models and theories, and some of them I've talked about before, so I will try to go a little bit faster. And some are new. So, as I'm starting with perception and action. Now, this is an area in psychology where there have been an amazing amount of research, amazing number of experiments, trying to understand, in particular, how we perceive the world around us. So, I've picked a few things here. I mean, I could, again, spend a whole course on this. I picked creative perception because it's one that is relevant to information visualization, but also to design of human interfaces in general. Because it's an interesting concept. And the observation is humans can recognize some visual features very rapidly. And there have been systematic studies to understand what those features are. So something like the line orientation, the blobs, the fact that things are grouped, the length, the thickness, the size of an object, the curvature, etc. The whole list is here. So if I give, if I show you images in quick succession where only one of these aspects changes, you will be able to perceive it. And that's an observation. The theory behind it is that we have neurons that are trained or specialized to recognize this feature, these features, by firing only once. Because the theory is that if we need to have more complex cognitive processes to analyze the, I'm tempted to say the image, but the data coming through your eyes, you wouldn't be able to do it so quickly. However, when you combine these changes, there are interferences, and you're not able to perceive pre-attentively. So the theory of pre-attentive perception by Trisman dates for about 20 years ago. And his theory is that at the level of visual perception, there is a parallel handling. Some things are, quote, computed or perceived in parallel. But when these things break down, then you have to go to a sequential treatment. Now, this links with Gestalt theory that I will talk about in a second. But first, a little experiment. So you all watch here. Now, the question is, how many blobs were different?
Two.
Oh, how many different?
How many different? Two.
Two.
Vertical and horizontal.
Yeah, how many were horizontal?
One.
One.
I saw one.
One.
One? Who saw one?
At least one.
Who saw at least one? Who saw more than one?
Maybe so.
We don't know. Well, I'll do it again.
One.
Yeah, there is one. So most of you won. Now here.
Three or four.
Well, you don't know.
Six. But the problem now is the
colors.
So, yes, the problem here is that I've varied two things, which is both the color and the orientation. And with two things varying, you get confused. And it would take you to go sequentially and count. So this is important because in information visualization and in the design of user interface, you try to make things that are easy to grasp visually. The thing is, our visual system is incredibly, incredibly powerful. So the shapes that flashed here at you were very simple, but I could flash images of people, and by flashing them a tenth of a second each, you would still be able to recognize, you know, I don't know, presidents and actors and people you've never met but you've seen. You'd be able to recognize people in your family. So in one tenth of a second, we can extract enough information from a face to distinguish from many, many other faces that we have in our brain. And this is something that Trisman's theory doesn't really answer, because it's more just than one of these dimensions varying at a time. What we start to understand is that humans are trained extremely early to distinguish a human face from anything else, and then to distinguish among human faces. How is this encoded? How can recognition occur so quickly? We still don't quite know. But what's becoming more and more obvious is that we don't store images in our brain. It's not even clear that we see images. I mean, yes, optically some image of reality is projected at the back of our eye, and then there's nerves going out of there. But the neurons don't do, you know, computer vision algorithms. They perceive features, things like the fact that an eye can be recognized very immediately is because somewhere it's encoded in there. Which will get us to Gibson's theory, among other things. I wanted to include, and I realized I forgot to do that, images where you take the image of a face and you turn the eyes and the mouth upside down, and you get absolutely horrible things. But other manipulations you can do and you don't perceive. So it's part of the what is still a mystery on how vision works. Now, not knowing exactly how it works may not be necessarily a problem. As designers of interactive systems, we don't necessarily need to have theories of visual perception. You know, if we have models that are descriptive enough and maybe to some level predictive, that's all we need. So the principles of Gestalt perception are interesting in that perspective, because even though it's called Gestalt theory, many things that are both theory are not really theories according to my definition. Although you can do a lot of experiments to show that these principles are in fact actually real. But I don't see really an explanatory theory behind that. So Gestalt perception is the idea that there are features of visual sensation that we perceive immediately and as a whole. So there is a classification of these. Objects that lie in a common area are perceived as a group. Proximity, when objects are close to each other, so the fact that the word proximity, common area, the word common area is written inside this blob, so I will group them as one entity. The word proximity is near this rectangle, so I will also group them. If further I put them away, the less grouping I will perceive. If they are far away, I can attach them together through connectivity by drawing a simple line. And these are things that, according to Gestalt perception, and later according to Gibson, we perceive instantaneously, or using Trisman theory, are pre-attentive. Other example, this is a well-known one. If I give you a grid of dots like this, well, you have grouping because they're close together. Now, if I play with the spacing, and you look at this, what do they look like?
Lines and groups.
Yes, so they are grouped by lines. And on the right?
Columns.
Yeah. But on the right, it's not as strong, you notice?
Yeah.
Because the difference between the spaces is not as big as here. Now, when you do the visual design of an interface or a visualization of some information, you can use these things to create an effect without having to put extra ink on paper, if you wish. So by grouping things like this, I can show lines that are not really there. Other examples from Gestalt theory is these two graphs show the power of symmetry. Now, are they the same?
Yeah. Well, it depends on the meaning of the arcs.
No.
Oh, okay.
No.
Okay, the connections are the same, but...
Well, I have the same nodes, one here is connected to 2 and 3, etc. So, they are the same graph. No?
yes and no.
Yes and no, okay.
The lines are the same, they seem to have the same meaning, but the distances are different. So,
but the graph,
well, the layout is the same. It's different, sorry, but the underlying graph is the same.
Yeah. You're still not convinced.
I'm surprised.
I think that Victor is thinking like in a map. That might be a different thing, but a graph is not spatial.
Yeah, I'm talking about the structure of the graph. My point here is that when you look at the right, at the one on the right, you see an obvious symmetry. Is that if I cut it here, this half, I can fold onto this one, it's exactly the same. If you look at the one on the left, for me it's not obvious. I don't know about you, but for me it's not obvious that there is symmetry. So we perceive symmetry also very quickly and very instantly. Now, the principles of this Gestalt perception have been an influence on James Gibson. I've talked about Gibson quite a bit already. So, Gibson actually said that, you know, what the Gestalt psychologists had found was very interesting, but they were not offering any theory. And so what he did was to proceed to build a theory of what he called ecological perception. And I would argue it is really a theory. If you read this book, which has this cover here, which I talked about before, it really builds a theory, and then it presents a number of experiments that have been run by him and others to support the theory. And still to this day, I mean, this was started in the 50s and 60s. There are still a number of people around the world who keep developing new aspects of the theory and testing it with new experiments. Now, it's called the ecological theory of perception because Gibson believes strongly that the animals in the world, the living things, as he calls them, have evolved with the environment. They have affected the environment, they have adapted the environment to make life easier for them. I mean, humans certainly, more than anything else, but animals as well. I mean, a bird is building a nest, animals, you know, build shelters, and things like this. So, what he's saying is that there's this coevolution between the organisms and their environment. And that also means that their perception capabilities evolve to adapt to the environment. And he's thinking that, and that's a very widespread hypothesis, that nature is parsimonious. It tries to minimize the amount of energy, for example, that needs to use to make things. So he's talking about perceptual processes being elegant and requiring as little processing as possible. And I think his information of information pickup, the fact that our perceptual senses, which for vision is not just the eye, but the fact that the eye is on the head, which is on the body, which can move, and that when we perceive, it's not just our eyes fixed looking at something, it's the whole process of us moving our heads and moving around and perceiving the environment through this rich influx of data, but that our senses have evolved to pick up this information very efficiently. Which gets us back to this pre-attentive processing from Trisman, that things that are important for us to survive have been optimized, if you want to put it this way, through evolution. So there is a part of the theory that is there's kind of a hypothesis that is not really trying to prove as such, but some hypothesis about how nature evolves and how animals co-evolve with the environment. And then he focuses on visual perception. And visual perception is really challenging most everything that had been done in psychology until that time. And what he's saying is that the animals and humans in particular have a perceptual system that is equipped to extract invariants from the environment. And that the what he calls the optical array, the thing that gets to the eyes, contains information about the environment. So we don't see a table or a wall, or what happens is that in the optical array, in the thing we perceive, there's information that specifies that something is a horizontal surface or a vertical surface or a curved surface. Now, this is something that is very hard to grasp at first try. I'm just rereading the book, and every time it's like, yes, it's very clever, it's not easy to grasp, and it's not easy to convey. But his take is the following, that what I perceive, if you think of what comes to my eye, not as an image, not as having sort of, you know, a CCD camera at the back of your eye, what we're seeing is solid angles. So the door there, in fact, I can think of it as a solid angle that comes from my eyes and goes all the way to the door. Now, when I move in the room, this solid angle is going to change slightly. As I go more sideways, it's going to come slower. If I go this way, and it's not actually happening here, but if I had the wall in there, it would progressively hide the door. So it will eat into the solid angle of that door to the point where it could disappear. But these processes are reversible. If I move back, the door reappears. And so he's making a theory of what he called ecological optics, about what you perceive in terms of these solid angles, not in terms of images, but in terms of these angles. And it's showing that you have a number of systematic things that happen where perception of depth, for example, is not we don't perceive depth. It's just that when an object gets occluded by another, then we know that one is in front of the other. But it's not perception of depth as such. So in this optical flow, which is the way the optical array changes as our eyes move, our head moves, our body moves, and also as the environment changes, all this contains information about what's out there in the world. And what we do is we extract those invariants, such as, for example, the direction of motion, which is the only fixed point. If I move forward, there is one point that doesn't move, and that's where I'm going. And his argument is that these things are perceived directly through what he calls information pickup. And once you get this notion that in the environment contains, well, I'm not sure I should say the environment contains information, but once you think of perception as extracting information from the optical array, and so from the environment, then you get to the notion of affordance, which is this notion that part of this information is capability for action. So if I perceive a surface as being knee-high and fairly solid and fairly horizontal, then it has an affordance for sitting. And the point is, because I am a human body who can sit, and I have this particular size, this particular rock or something environment will have the affordance for sitting. If I were I don't know, an ant, or if I were an elephant, this same rock doesn't have that same affordance. So the affordance is really a relationship between the animal and the environment. Some affordances are directly perceivable, some you need to learn to perceive them, but whether you want it or not, the affordance is there, and a lot of what we do is to learn to perceive those affordances. So in the context of ecological optics, it talks about this action-perception coupling where you need to move in order to perceive the variation in the flow and the invariance. So it's an example where it's a very powerful theory, in my opinion. It's not an easy theory because it challenges the way we think about perception. It has some strong arguments about why the others are wrong. But it's a theory that even though they've conducted a number of experiments to support the theory, is not easy for us to use when we design user interfaces. You can try to think in terms of ecological optics, you can try to think in terms of the optical array, you can try to think in terms of affordances, but it's not something where the gap between the theory and the application to designing interactive systems has been done yet.
Is there a link between this theory and Don Norman's like externalizing information and stuff like that?
Yes.
Because, I mean, I see similar approaches here.
Well, Don Norman is known to be the person who brought affordances in the world of HCI. There's an interesting, a long story and complicated story to tell about whether he understood it or not. It's funny because I'm rereading the book now, and I think Norman was more right than he's written that he thought he was, because he sort of backpedaled on affordances by saying he was talking about cultural affordances, and Gibson was talking about other things. I think they were much closer than I don't know, my reading tells me it's a bit different, because the whole point about Norman is that what he's really talking about is the perceived affordances. If the affordance is there but you don't perceive it, it's not good. And so in the context of designing user interfaces, you want to make sure the affordances are perceivable. When I showed you the other day, you know, this thing where you have a little icon in the title bar of the window, and in fact, you can actually grab this icon and move it and put it, you know, to attach the message to the file to the email or something. I think most of you were surprised because the affordance that this particular icon, even though every other icon that looks like this in the Finder would have an affordance to be moved, this one somehow didn't because it belonged in a place where you don't think it's movable, which you could relate to Gibson's notion of attached versus detached object. And maybe, you know, the clue are not right to show that this is movable. But Gibson talks about the fact that these affordances have to be learned. Not all affordances are innate in his model. This notion of affordances there's a sentence in Gibson saying, says most of our knowledge of the world, our knowledge is in the world, which certainly echoes Gibson's approach. It also links to something I will not talk about today, but is an interesting theory of distributed cognition, of how cognition is distributed in the world and how people share cognition through shared artifacts. So this is the work of researchers at UCSD, University of California, San Diego, where Norman comes from, or spent most of his career. And it's by, and I'm always terrible with the people's names, it will come back to me. It's Jim Holland, but the main author is not Holland. So around this notion of
ecological approach in general, there are a number of things in HCI that are close, and a lot of them reference Gibson. So now we move to Higgs law and Fitts law. So these are things I've talked about before, Fitts law in particular, so I'm not going to tell you more about this. But let me tell you a little bit about Higgs law. So these are empirical laws where people have observed a phenomenon. They obviously had a theory in the back of their mind. And in both cases, which is why I put them here together, the theory was about the notion of the information theory. So in Higgs' law, the question is how much time it takes to select an item in a set. So the kind of task that I can give you is I give you a list of names and I ask you, is this particular word in the list? And you have to answer yes or no. Well, if you do that, you will find that the time it takes is proportional to the log of the number of items. Again, like in Fitts law, A and B are constants. They may depend on some of the conditions, but the important thing is this logarithmic term here. Now, where does that come from? Well, first of all, in the same way as Fitts law, this law has limits. If you have too many items, you have to go through them sequentially, and you will not be in that. You won't be following the law. So,
is it n or n by 2?
Why would it be n by 2?
I mean, there are two make choices.
Yes?
Between. No, forget.
Well, yeah, I give you a list of words, and I tell you, is this word in the list? And you answer yes or no as fast as you can. The time it takes will grow logarithmically with the number of items. Now, it's a bit more tricky than that because... Sorry?
If the elements are ordered, are sorted?
Well, of course. If the elements are sorted, it's no, but... I don't have time to go into the details of the... but the reason I mention this is because there's a lot of talk about Fitts law. But Higgs law is actually something that is important as well, because if you think of the tasks you're doing, a lot of it has to do with doing visual search for the element you need to get to, and then doing a pointing gesture to that. And so, yes, we can try to optimize for this, but this can then dominate the time it takes to find something. I think there's not much you can do about Higgs law, because it's really about processing information. The only thing you can do is better organize it visually. So yeah, if things are sorted, you will go faster, if you know they're sorted. but also it says that it links to the Miller's 7 plus or minus 2 paper as well. It may be more efficient to have several smaller tasks in succession than one with a big set. Because when you have a big set, this collapses. I need to move on, so since I already talked about this quite a bit, I'll move on. The last one, I think, in this section, which is the kinematic chain theory, which is due to Ibiard, who's a French psychologist. And he's looked at the laterality of motor control. We have two hands, and yet we are right-handed or left-handed. And so classical psychology treated the non-dominant hand, so the left hand for a right-handed person, as a bad version of the dominant hand. Because if you do experiments of you're trying to write with your left hand or with your right hand, you're trying to do pointing, or some similar tasks,
your non-dominant hand will perform less well.
So what Ibghiar did was to observe actually how people use their hands. And what he observes is that the two hands are used very differently. So this is a classical thing when you try to build theories. Are we using our hands differently because one is better than the other? Or is one, quote, better than the other because we use them differently? When he gives this talk, and I've asked him, I've been lucky to work with him, and I saw him giving a talk where he was talking about, what's it called? A type of crab that has two claws, and they evolved to be very different. One is extremely big and extremely strong, but not very precise, and it's used for crushing whatever the crab wants to eat. And the other one is small and more agile, and is there to pick the pieces of food out of the things that hasn't been crushed. Now, in humans, the two hands have evolved, you know, they're remarkably similar, unlike this crab. But still, in human, usage of the two hands is extremely different. And for many, many tasks, and he's found very few exceptions, the non-dominant hand is acting first and is establishing the frame of reference, the context in which the dominant hand is acting. And so because it's establishing the context, you don't need as much precision. So for example, you're writing. Yes, you. And you're holding your notebook with your left hand. Yes. Now, if I were to look at where you write on the table relative to versus where you write relative to your notebook, you'd find that you adjust the position of the notebook as you write. So in fact, even though you're covering a whole page, relative to the desk, you would write an area this big. So your left hand, if you're right-handed, is moving the piece of paper around to make your right hand always write where it's more efficient, comfortable, etc. The positioning of the left hand is, you know, it can be a couple of millimeters off, it's not a big deal. The writing needs to be more precise. But you can see this in many, many tasks you do every day. Even things like when you sweep the floor, which you do every day, one of your hands, and usually it's the non-dominant hand, is going to be used as a pivot point. So it positions the broom, and then the other one is going to do more of a gesture. Now, some tasks are easier to turn around than others, and it depends on the environment and where you are relative to the furniture in the room and things like this. But when you cook, for example, you tend to use your left hand to hold the pan and the right hand to stir or do the ingredients. So when you look at it, most tasks we do with two hands are asymmetric. And there are these rules that the left hand acts first and is doing what is called distal control, versus the dominant hand is doing the proximal control. And the reason he's calling his theory the kinematic chain is that if you think of just one arm, you have fingers. What are the, what's called, the knuckles? Phalange, yes, in French. That I know. Okay, so I don't know what the... I know the knuckle is the articulation, here, the joint. Anyway, you have bits of your finger that is articulated on your hand. The hand is articulated at the wrist, and then at the elbow, and then at the shoulder. Now, this is an articulated body, which means it gives you both range through movement at the what's called the distal, away from the end of the chain, gives you range, and the distal part of the limb gives you precision. Yes?
Now, here's the leap of faith that you have to do, is to think of your left hand, or your left arm, as continuing this chain towards more distal control. Right? So what you do with your left hand is you do coarse grain positioning of objects, like what you do with your shoulder or elbow, where you do coarse positioning for the rest of the chain. So it's a kinematic chain that goes, that starts at the fingertips of the dominant hand, goes up to the shoulder, and then still goes up to the left hand.
It was last week I heard someone talking about her aunt who has a sickness or illness, and it is that she can't. She's both-handed, and it's really, really, really bad, like hard to live with that, because I didn't understand really, but maybe now better, that she didn't know how to do things, and she was really clumsy because she was as like both hands were the best hands.
Okay, well, that's an interesting story. I can do more about it, but...
Because first you'd think it would be good because you would do everything, but
yeah. Apparently it's not. No, but I can understand that. I think our brain gets wired very early on using this two hands in asymmetric ways and complementary ways, that if somehow this... you lose this, or you don't have this, it's confusing. It's like it makes me think of something completely different, someone who had lost, through an accident to the brain, the sense of pain. And you think, well, that's great, right? This person is miserable. Because by losing the sense of pain, he lost also a sense of the emotion of feeling other people's, understanding other people's emotions. There was a documentary on TV. It was frightening. And sometimes, you feel like it would be good to have this or not have that, and then there are actual people who have these problems, and you realize it's not that good. So, here and here.
So, that's a little bit funnier than what you just thought, but I had a teacher who was as a child left-handed,
mm-hmm.
So he worked with his left hand, and then his parents told him to, no, it's the wrong way,
oh, yeah,
to
yeah,
use
yeah.
your
yeah.
right hand. So he tried to use his right hand to write, to do anything, but then as he were 20, he said, I were left-handed, so I'll try to use this one. And he was able, for a time, to use his both hands to write different things.
Wow.
In the same beauty. Writing. That was pretty amazing.
It is. I mean, but that's the thing, is we are amazing. And we don't know it. So yeah, some people get to discover it. And the thing is that you can train yourself to do a lot of crazy things. I think it's really fascinating when it happens sort of without much explicit. But yeah, I mean, there was a lot. I mean, I remember when I was a kid, if you were left-handed, it was really terrible. And there were teachers in school who would attach your hand behind your back, to force you to write with your right hand.
But nowadays he can write as bad as with one hand and with the other.
Yes.
I don't know if it's great. So.
Yeah, well.
And I had an experience like that.
Yes?
I had a problem with my hand.
Yeah.
So I forced to use the left one. So I gave exams in maths with that hand. And after that hand became okay, I couldn't be very adaptable to what happened. I mean, I used my left hand even when I could use my right. I was really confused
yes.
after that, what hand should I use in simple tasks. So,
well, the brain has an amazing level of plasticity,
yeah.
right? And so it can rewire itself in
fairly short time. I told this story of the person who was wearing glasses that invert top and bottom, so things were inverted. And after a while, this person was able to drive a car. And then when he took the glasses off, it was like it took a while to rewire the things, but it still happened. So yeah, people, and actually this is both a blessing and a curse, because we adapt to things, and I think it's key to our survival. But when you design interfaces, people adapt to whatever you throw at them, and then when you give them a better version, but they've adapted to the other one, they find it.
Right. After that, I mean, yeah. I would have had to,
That doesn't surprise me, but so it's really a proof of this plasticity and how your body and your brain adapt to changing circumstances, and how fast this can happen. I mean, you have examples of people who've had either because of a brain tumor or some accident, parts of the brain removed, and some of the functions have been recovered. In really very short time. So okay, let me get moving a little bit here. I would like to finish this before the break. So these are models and theories about cognition and behavior. So I talked about action theory already. So this 7 stages model of how we form a goal, specify a sequence of actions to reach this goal, execute it. So Norman calls this the execution distance, and separates it between articulatory cognitive distance and articulatory input distance. So that's about, you know, thinking what you want to do, how you're going to do it, and actually doing it. And it's showing that depending on the systems, he was comparing in particular command line interfaces with graphical user interfaces. This distance in particular is much shorter in a graphical user interface. And then you have the evaluation phase, where you perceive the change of state of the system or the non-change of state, interpret it, and evaluate it relative to the goal. And here you also have the evaluation distance that is split between the articulatory distance and the cognitive distance. So perceiving what's changed and understanding if you reached your goal or not. I've talked about this before, so I'm not going to talk more about it. I think it was interesting at the time. I think it's a little bit limited. You can analyze interfaces and try to see if the usability problems are at which of these 4 stages they are, but it doesn't necessarily help you solve them. So, you know, it's not bad, but it's not great either. Situated action is something I've talked a little bit about as well. It came out of Lucy Sachman's thesis, and she's an anthropologist who studied people at Xerox and observed how there was this. At the time, you know, the cognitivist movement was getting big. And there was also all the people doing work on artificial intelligence. And everything was based around the fact that as humans, you know, we create a plan for action and then we just stick to the plan. And that's how, which is in a sense a little bit reflected in Don Norman's action theory as well. What she observed is that, well, it's more complicated than that. Yes, people have plans, but then they're confronted to the situation. And if things break down, or if things the environment changes, then they adapt to the changing conditions, and they can do this very easily. So, what she did is what's called the ethnomethodological approach, by detailed analysis of work practices, by observing people for hours and hours and days, and modeling the causal chains that she was observing. Someone goes to the photocopier to make a copy, and the copier is out of paper or out of toner or something, and the person will, you know, some will decide to fix it, some will just go away, some will give up printing the thing altogether, some will go to another printer and things like this, some will ask someone to fix it for them, etc. And this, not, you know, when things break down, you don't plan in advance. When you go to the copier, you don't think, okay, so what am I going to do if it's out of paper? You do that on the spot. So what this notion of situated action emphasizes is the role of the context. Human action takes place in the complex context. And the plan is used as a guide, but our actions adjust to that context. And at the same time, they modify the context for yourself and for the others. Now, this is done in the anthropological way, where it's really about observing and describing. It's not telling you anything about how to fix it, or if there is anything to fix for that matter, maybe. In a sense, people are pretty good at fixing things by themselves. So the role of situated action is really more a role of when you observe situations, pay attention not to just what people do, but also to the context of action. Now, situated action, in a sense, builds a little bit on what's called activity theory, which was originally developed in the Soviet Union by Vygotsky and Leontief. And their goal was to analyze human activity and understand how this activity is organized among people, and also what is the relationship between the human actors and the things they do and the objects they use. And the strong observation here is that the subject-object relationship is mediated by tools. And there are technical tools, or what they call psychological instruments. So if I am performing music, I need someone to perform the music, I need an instrument to play the music, but also need what they call psychological tools, which are things like the notion of harmony, or the rules for composing music. And these are mediators in that they help achieve the goals. So Vygotsky looked most predominantly at the activity of single subjects, and Leontief added the role of the community. And the role of the community is to regulate how the work, the labor, is divided among people, and whether this and how to make this division of labor effective. So it goes through rules and sometimes rituals. And I'm going to show this first. So you have this notion that the interaction between the subject and the object, between the human actor and the things they're trying to achieve, is mediated by instruments, and computers are a particular part of type of instrument. But that's not everything. There's also the role of the community. And the community also mediates interaction between subject and object by deciding who is going to do what. And then you have the third triangle here, which is that the mediation between subject and community is done by rules. Rules include the social roles that we have, the jobs that we have. So, you know, if I'm working in a research lab, there are people who do research, there are people who do administrative work, there are people who do technical aspects of things. So it's a way to organize the community. And then there's a division of labor, which is how the community decides who achieves what goals. So it's a very I mean, it's not an abstract model. In fact, it's pretty concrete. But it's a little bit like many of these theories coming from social psychology or sociology are, you know, they're not operational example. It's not like I can take this and go off and design a better interactive system. There's a lot of work in between to fill the gaps.
I've seen some work where they use activity theory to evaluate some games, like World of Warcraft.
Yeah.
I mean, they study how division of labor happens with different characters and
yes.
what kind of tools. I think it's from Bonnie and Artie.
Yes. Yeah, Bonnie and Artie is one of the, together with Susanna Butker, whose name was on the slide here. Susanna Butker is really the one who brought activity theory to the field of HCI, and then she worked with Bonnie and Artie, as a matter of fact, and then Bonnie and Artie is really one of the big proponent of this. There's also a whole aspect in HCI called activity what's it called? Activity something. Where the goal is to represent the activities explicitly in the system, so the system can know which activity you're in, and you can get information to the system about which activity you're conducting. So when you change activity, it will launch the right applications for you and open the right documents and things like this. Activity-based computing now. Now, I think there's a level that is more directly actionable in there, and it's this notion of actions and operations. So there's a notion of activity, which is sort of the overall context of, you know, why are we here and what are we doing? But then there's, so that would be the level of the goal in Norman's theory. And then there's actions and the operations. And that's a distinction you don't find in Norman's theory, or in not quite in situated action. Actions are things that you execute consciously to reach an explicit goal. And operations are executed unconsciously or semi-consciously to execute the actions. So I think I have an example here. No. okay, but imagine, you know, you wake up in the morning and you have to go to class. Now, a number of these things are going to be, the first time you come here, it's a little of an action because you have to be conscious about which bus to take and where to stop and find your way, etc. So you do this very consciously. And after a while, through repetition, this gets internalized and they become actions. They are, you don't think about it. You walk to the bus, you're half awake and you don't have to think. Except that one day there's a bus strike and then suddenly what used to be an operation goes back to the little action because you have to think and have an alternative plan. And I think it's something you see a lot in user interfaces where, and to me it's a better way of looking at it than this traditional distinction between a novice user and an expert user, which I find very sort of limiting. There are things you do in interactive systems as well as in real life that become automated, and things that you have to do consciously. And becoming expert, to use that terminology, is really when you internalize things. But when things break down, they come back to being conscious actions. So that sort of links a little bit what we saw about the repair theory that I had in earlier class, situated action and activity theory. This notion of things that we do semi-automatically, things we do consciously, and the fact that it can go back and forth. Okay, something quite different. Cognitive dimensions. So, this is work that was done by Thomas Green, his cognitive psychology professor in the UK. And he worked a lot on the psychology of programming. There's been a lot of work, it's less strong now, but it was
in the 80s, a lot of work on the psychology of programming, understanding programmers, what they do, how they work, and understanding as well how programming languages could better support the type of things that programmers do. There is a conference on psychology of programming. And so he worked a lot of that on that, and then later in his career he sort of got interested more in interactive systems and graphical user interfaces. And he created this framework. Now, framework is a word I didn't define. It's somewhere between a model and a theory. Framework is used a lot in social sciences, where people describe their observations, but they don't want to call it a model, because a model gives an impression of something that is very general and applicable to everything and everybody. A framework is sort of like a model, but with the notion that it applies to only this particular cases we've observed. There is no attempt to generalize. So sociologists and anthropologists are very careful about these things. So here I would call this more also a framework, in that it doesn't pretend to be general, but it's interesting because it has a generative aspect, in that it can help you to fix problems or to look for new solutions. So looking at how people use computer systems, he created this taxonomy of activities that people do. And I have to say, I mean, I've used this a couple of times to look at things. We used it when we were working on the SpeechNet editor, and it's pretty good. It's pretty good. So, one activity is incrementation, adding new stuff, creating a document from scratch or drawing from scratch. Transcription is also a case where you add things, but it doesn't come from your brain, it comes from another source. And we certainly saw in our case that transcription was done in a very different way from incrementation. Modification is changing something that exists and maybe adapted to a new problem. Exploration is trying things out to find a solution, sometimes not even to find a solution, just to understand how things work. Search, looking for an object that may not exist because you want to operate in that object. And comprehension is to discover is distinguishing exploration, where you try and error to find a solution, from comprehension, where you want to discover new aspects of the system. And based on these activities, he created what he calls his cognitive dimensions, which are, so I think it's more or less a quote from one of his papers, aspects of the informational structure. Now, informational structure is a general term that is using to describe, you know, the text of a program when it was working on programming languages, or the visual aspect of a user interface. But not just the visual aspect, but sort of the maybe conceptual model that's behind it. So aspect of this informational structure that can be analyzed according to the activity. So for each of these activities, there are properties of the system that may make the interaction more or less efficient. So one is viscosity, which he defines as resistance to change. A lot of systems make it hard for you to change your mind, or to change things. If I'm in Word and I want to change the style of the paragraph to give a different margin, for example, I have to go through a complicated set of steps. So there's viscosity for that in Word, whereas adding new text is very easy. Visibility, ability to see components. I'm not going to go through all of them. A couple that I like, committer commitment. Systems often ask you to make decisions before you want to make the decision. The reason we lose a lot of data on computers is because we don't want to save, because when you save, you need to give a file name, and I don't want to think about the file name yet. Right? So I don't save, and then the thing crashes, and I lost everything. If I could save without giving the name just right now, I wouldn't have this permissive commitment issue, and I would not lose my work. Hidden dependencies is also a problem you see all the time, where things depend on each other, but the system doesn't tell you how and why. Consistency. So, interestingly, some of these you find are similar to some of the principles I gave when I was talking about conceptual model last time, like consistency and visibility, certainly. And of course, defining each of them with one line is not giving justice to Thomas Green, so you'd have to read his papers to see more details about this. So what I like about these cognitive dimensions is that they are at a fairly high level, but they are still very operational. You can really apply them fairly easily. And that's it. So we can have a break, unless you have questions. Well, we can have questions and a break, actually. And then we'll get to interaction. So models and theories created specifically for HCI.
For everyone,
I don't remember your Benjamin brought this book that he found at his mother's, right?
Yeah.
Which is this catalog of objects. And that seems to be an original edition. So if you want to look through it at the break, it's here.
These are 20 examples of what could bad designs be.
Yes, that's one good way to look at it. Okay, so let's start in, starting at 11.
I was wondering, is there like any company or any university or anything that has